for snowing last week in Chicago, so be thankful. it's great to be back, and I want to tell you about some work that we've been doing, which is I think would be useful to interpreting Lenzen data. And Lenzen data, I try to give a sample here of what kind of data we have now at hand. We have weak Lenzen data, which traces the mass distribution clusters to large, to very large UDI, and I think this is Tommaso's image, right?
Stone lensing, which probes the mass distribution in the inner regions, and then multivalence observation where people compile optical X-ray and lensing information to give very stringent constraint on the mass distribution and what's going on in the emergent system like this, like this bullet cluster. It's amazing. This data is really amazing because if you think about 10 years back, right, none of these pictures would be possible. So there's a lot of progress observation on it. So the question that is relevant is what do we do with this data, and we have to have a way of modeling it or interpreting it, understanding what it tells us. And so what I'll be telling you today is kind of effort to provide some information which can be useful interpretation of the data. And so I'll talk about Siri, which may be underlying all of these observations, and Siri is in the background here, so it comes second, data is first. So here are my collaborators. I'll talk about a number of projects I've been working on, and these are the main collaborators, although there's often many other people who contributed to the project. The primary people who are responsible for simulation, Daisuke Nagai, who's actually here, he's just in a different seminar room, and Douglas Rudd, who is a graduate from Chicago, so he's looking for jobs this fall. If you guys are looking for very adept numerical person, remember this name and remember this face. Here's this background cluster, and for those people who know, this is a mythical cluster 6. But really, it's a Virgo size, it's a very fairly typical Virgo size cluster formed in Lambda CDM cosmology. And I showed the same picture 2 weeks ago at the conference, illustrating that subhalos are undergoing tidal stripping. But I'll use the same figure to show a different thing here, which is more relevant to this talk. And what you can see here from this picture is kind of in a graphical way. Two very generic predictions of CDM cosmology. One is that the mass distribution in halos is cuspy, meaning that the density increases from the outer regions inwards, but it never really flattens, so it never forms a profile. And you can kind of see it here because these particles are colored on a logarithm of local density, and you can see that this color becomes more and more intense as you move in, so you don't really see a big region that where density is constant, density keeps increasing. The second really striking appearance of this cluster that you can see that it's not spherical, it's a distribution of mass and distribution of subhalos, and this cluster is very elongated. If you go and measure and try to fit ellipsoids to it, you'll find that it's triaxial with fairly low ratio of longest to shortest axis.
What's the scale under? How far?
It's roughly a couple of video radii that you're looking at here. So it's not a very small scale, but it encompasses more or less the entire relaxed region, virialized region. So these two generic predictions are really borne out by observations, at least approximately, although some interesting differences may start to emerge, as I'll show you. So this is profiles, total mass profiles, derived from the Chandra data for a sample of relaxed clusters where you can apply hydrostatic equilibrium analysis and derive the mass profiles. This work that was done led by Alex Vihlinin and published this year. It's a dozen clusters, so there's not many systems, but so far for this dozen systems, what seems to be happening is that mass profiles are approximately self-similar, and their shape is consistent with the expected shape. In this case, this is just an FW profile shown with a typical concentration shown for comparison with this yellow line. You can see that the shape is roughly there. It's not really isothermal. The slope seems to be rolling and increasing in the outskirts. What's interesting also is that you can see in this mass profile, you can start to see for the smallest groups for which central galaxy is kind of a more dominant fraction of the mass, you actually see the increase of mass due to the central galaxy in the center. The gas profile is less than similar, so this is gas density profile for this cluster, so there is more scatter when profiles are normalized to this to the virial radius. And I should say that if clusters were fully self-similar, if they were just scaled versions of each other, what you expected, all of these profiles would just line up and be one line. So any deviation, any scatter in this plot indicates some deviation from self-similarity. But in general, the mass distribution clusters looks like NFW. And you can also look at how concentrated it is compared to what you expect from cosmological simulations. This is a plot of halo concentration as a function of cluster mass. And the only thing that I want different from usual figures of this kind is that concentration here is defined with respect to radius enclosing 500, of a density of 500 critical. And this is just because the data that was used here only extends to that over density. For those of you who are more familiar with virial radius, R500 is approximately half of the virial radius. So the mass profiles derived from hydrostatic equilibrium for these Chandra clusters were fit with NFW profile, excluding the inner region. And these are the concentrations that you get. Ignore these circles and squares for now. I'll come back to them later. What I want you to focus on is this line, the solid line with the thinner lines indicating the scatters that you expect from cosmological simulations in lambda CDM cosmology, and compare them to these stars, which represent the Chandra clusters. You can see that these stars are roughly fall in the expected range of C of M relations. But so this is good. There's no obvious disagreement, like, for example, for low surface brightness galaxies. For clusters, if you look at concentration, they look to be OK. But there is a catch. When we did this comparison, we saw that sigma 8 is closer to 0.9, and that's why the line is plotted for concurrence cosmology with sigma 8 of 0.9. Now it seems like sigma 8 is actually substantially lower, and concentrations are very sensitive to sigma 8. This is a paper that came out actually a few weeks ago by David Boerti et al., where they actually stress the point that if you use WMAP3 cosmology to compare concentrations for groups and clusters, it seems like concentrations that are inferred from observations are actually too high, way too high, almost by a factor of 2. So here the points are groups and clusters. Some of them were observed by this group. Some they were reusing the same data that I showed you by Vihlinin et al. With this blue line is a fit, a parallel fit to the relation. First, you can see that there is they detect dependence of concentration on mass with approximately the slope that's predicted by simulations. But the amplitude is considerably higher than this green line, which is really what you expect from dissipational simulations for WMAP 3-year cosmology.
Yes. Are all of those observed clusters relaxed?
Yeah. So all of these, that's a key, I think, to maybe understanding this difference. So all of these points are mass distributions derived from hydrostatic equilibrium.
And this is, so your theory here is dark matter only or includes?
Good question. So that's what I'm leading to. So far, so this prediction is coming from dissipational simulations. And I think this may explain part of this difference. But it's interesting that we're starting to test the models and predictions for these things at this kind of level.
This is a simulation, or is it just based on early formula actually derived from other kind of simulation?
So let me explain what these lines are. So this line is just a fit to the data. Data is the points, right? And these two lines are two different versions of analytical model of Bullock et al.
Yeah.
So this is original one, and this one is modified, parameters are modified to fit the data by Klaus Dolak et al. So there is a little bit uncertain. I think you should trust really this one,
the green line,
yes. But I don't think
mean concentration, like
other functions,
not split on age or anything, but just the average.
That's right. So you're starting to bring up you guys starting to analyze the difference now. So one of the possible explanations is that these relaxed clusters actually represent the early forming tail of the distribution for which we know that concentration should be higher on average. But I think the difference here, if you look, this is a log scale, right? And the difference is about 0.2 in DEC. This is almost factor of 2. I don't think you can explain it easily by just formation time.
And how are this is from X-ray?
It's all from X-ray, hydrostatic equilibrium. So I'll show you one possible source. So one explanation that I actually discussed in this paper is that maybe this is these clusters are relaxed, so their formation times are shifted. They represent a biased tail of the total cluster population, and that maybe explains some of the difference, but I don't think it can explain all of it. I'll show you one effect that can explain part of this as well, and I have an idea for the third reason, which may be explaining all of this difference But I won't be talking about it today. If you're interested, ask me afterwards.
Again,
it's a good question. Different observers do it in different way, but usually it's some sort of measure, and sometimes subjective measure of how asymmetric a cluster is and how much substructure it contains from X-rays.
So the isophotes are smooth?
Yeah, so if you see that isophotes are smooth, you know, and there is no distortion, and there is no substructure, then a lot of substructure. If it's obviously not merging, then people consider it to be relaxed.
But so the claim is that with X-rays you can measure concentrations to 10%. That's what those error bars show. Is that?
I think the error bars are larger than 10%, because remember, this is log.
0.05 in log 10 is 10-15% in log
E. Yeah. Well, it's actually from, if we did, we repeated some of this analysis on mock observations of simulated clusters. And the statistical error that you get is very small. So the mass distribution is well contained. But I think the systematic errors may be there, which are not reflected in these error bars. So the second prediction, triaxiality of clusters, this is a kind of state of the art for predictions from dark matter only simulations. Work done by Brandon Allgood et al. Also published this year. What you see here is average longest to shortest axis ratio as a function of halo mass from lambda CDM cosmology simulations. The points represent what you measure in simulations, and then these lines are parallel fits to them. And there is a scatter around the mean relation. So you see that the general trend is that as you go to higher mass halos, halos have become more triaxial on average. And clusters I expect to be very triaxial. You see that the longest to shortest to longest, should be the opposite. Axis ratios are 0.4, 0.5 for cluster masses. And this triaxiality is expected to increase with redshift. As you go back in redshift, these are the same measurement, but for a number of redshifts. For a given mass, for a fixed mass, you see that the triaxiality goes down. So halos become more triaxial. And that reflects just the higher rate of mergers at higher redshifts.
So, because for these very high mass clusters, you have a very elongated kind of structure.
Mm-hmm.
So then when you do observation, then you are measuring X-ray. And then, of course, then eventually convert that into a spherically averaged kind of profile.
Mm-hmm.
And in a simulation, you also do that, but then do it in a different way. Well, that also give you some difference because, X-ray direct average
right.
of the density.
You're asking what kind of effect the triaxiality of the Khmer distribution has on concentration.
Yeah.
I don't think it has such a large effect. So although the distribution is triaxial, when you do the spherically averaged analysis, it doesn't seem to introduce that much bias.
Plus the potential is presumably.
And yeah, but potential is much more round, of course.
Yeah, I guess that's not the case in the simulation. If you fit NFW over to the simulation, but weighting the points with any square, actually, okay? So do you think it will?
So we have not done this type of exercise, but what I'll show you is that you can actually do better, because I'll talk about simulations with gas dynamics, where you can actually construct a mock observation of X-rays. So you can construct an X-ray data just from simulation data and apply the same fitting procedure. So we are not finding a strong bias, strong statistical error in that, but there is bias in concentration that may exist. Actually significant, although I cannot really tell you the answer because we've been looking at it this week and I don't have results yet. But I can tell you what the source is. The source is underestimate of mass at large radii due to turbulent motions. But it's really not outside the subject here, so I don't want to really spend quite a lot of time. So the triaxiality is predicted to increase with redshift, but also it's higher for inner regions of halos. So as you go in the cluster, the ratio, the axis ratio, actually decreases towards the inner regions, meaning that the inner regions are more triaxial than the outskirts. And that kind of sounds counterintuitive, but there is physics behind it. The outer regions form later, and the accretion is more spherical, so they become more symmetrical. Whereas inner regions, remember this time of the last major merger, which makes them very triaxial. But all of these predictions, and that's a problem, are made from dissipational simulations. But guess what? Clusters have variants in them, and galaxies in particular. And
how inconsiderate.
Yeah, this would be, life would be much simpler, although less interesting as well, I think, if there would be no galaxies. So the rest of my talk is essentially trying to assess what kind of effects presence of variance and formation of galaxies may have on the mass distribution of clusters, and that, of course, is something that could be used to interpret lensing. So I'll be using simulations, two types of simulations. One is a set of 16 individual galaxy clusters simulated with and without cooling. So in all of these simulations, essentially what we're doing is that we're starting from the same initial conditions, the same set of the same density field initially, and then we just vary in physics. In some simulations, we just have dark matter only. In some, we add gas, but this gas is non-radiative, so essentially just a component that follows equations of gas dynamics, so it's collisional. And then the third type of simulations, we also allow gas to cool. And when it condenses, it reaches high density, it starts forming stars. There's an algorithm of formation of stars, and stars can enrich the gas, which affects cooling, and so on and so on. And the two sets of simulations, one is this individual galaxy clusters, where you just focus on one cluster at a time, a Lagrangian region of few VRL radii around the center of the cluster. And they were extracted from boxes of around 100 megaparsec, and the design of the sample is such that it covers more or less uniformly the mass range from 10 to 14 to 10 to 15. And there were no particular selection criteria for what these clusters should be. They weren't selected to be relaxed or look nice. They just were kind of randomly selected to have masses in this range. The second set of simulations is we just used 68 inverse megaparsec volume, which is not large, but it was enough for the purposes for which we used it. And we just resolved all of this volume with uniform resolution, so not focusing on one region, but simulating the entire volume. And again, starting from the same initial conditions, but including different physics, like not only gas non-radiative regime, and then gas with all the physics. The simulations.
Constraint simulations?
No, they're just random fields. So clusters, of course, what we do is that for clusters, we run a low-resolution simulation, then we identify where a cluster forms, and then we use zoom-in initial conditions to actually focus on that region. For this set of simulation, we just use a random volume, random initial condition. And they were simulated with adaptive mesh refinement, which allows us to reach high resolution in high-density regions, and that's a typical resolution of the simulations. So particle mass about 10 to 9, resolution is few kiloparsecs, and there's this physics that we've included. So the most interesting for the purpose of this talk is that radiative cooling and heating of the gas was included. So the gas in some of the simulations can radiatively cool and condense. So this is just to illustrate that in this simulation, you do form clusters of galaxies. You have systems where, in addition to the dark matter clumps, you have stellar clumps as well. And we can't resolve the internal structure of these clumps very well, but we can identify them as galaxies, as distinct stellar clumps. And you can see the CD galaxy, very central, bright central galaxy, and a bunch of smaller galaxies in this Virgo-sized cluster. And I'll be using these simulations to answer these two questions, which I really were already in the title.
So for these stars, I mean, if you compare with observation, they're far off, or they're more or less, you know, match what you observe?
Yeah, so
stellar mass or?
Right, and that's a very important question that I want to talk about next, because of course when you start talking about these effects, you can ask whether we got the physics right. And one piece of physics that's not in the simulations is AGN bubbles, and so this is not included. I was at a conference in Garching 2 months ago, and this was really, I think, would be an artist's impression of what this conference was like. people have a lot of fun with bubbles, and there is lots of very good observations that show that AGNs do deposit energy in clusters. The problem that and conclusion that I got from this conference, that nobody knows exactly what they're doing, how they're depositing the energy, and how to model them. And so I think we'll really be stuck if we actually have to include these things. But so far in this simulation, just to make clear, this physics is not included. And of course, there's other types of physics that people consider, magnetic fields, cosmic rays, and so on, that's also not included in the simulation. So the question about how well it other simulations in describing the real clusters is an interesting one. And I think the jury is out. I don't think, for galaxies, I don't think we are reproducing properties of galaxies in these simulations very faithfully, although some of them actually turn out to be not so bad. But we don't really expect to, because the resolution is not really good enough to resolve the entire structure of these galaxies. But you can ask question about the growth properties of clusters. For example, what fraction of baryons is cooling into stars, condensing and cooling, right? And that's a good question, because for a long time, people knew that if we pretty much any simulation with any code and any numerical techniques that's been done, you roughly end up with 30% of baryons within the virial radius in condensed form, in the form of stars. And that number seems to be much higher than what people observe. The numbers observationally quoted are typically in the range of 5 to 15%. Although this number seems to depend on mass. And I think Dennis talked about it 2 weeks ago, that there's pretty obvious mass dependence of this fraction. So I'm not sure what's going on, but it's essentially, if we look at the stars, we seem to overproduce the stars, because these simulations are similar to others in this respect, and they are approximately 30 to 40%, depending on the radius in which you count these stars, of baryons end up in stellar component. And that seems to be too high. But clusters are really, especially massive clusters, they're really closed systems. Their mass is so large that it's very difficult to get baryons out of the virial radius. The energy that you require is enormous. So supernova feedback that's put in the simulation, definitely not enough to do that. And I think AGN feedback is not enough either. So if you look at within the virial radius, these clusters contain roughly universal baryon fraction. And so if you convert gas into stars, you should see, and you overproduce stars, you also should see that you underproduce gas density, right? Because it's a zero-sum game. So we can look at the gas density profile and compare it to X-ray data, X-ray observations. And this comparison that's shown here. This is the same sample of relaxed clusters from McLean et al. This Chandra observation shown by magenta here. And the yellow and blue lines show predictions of simulations. Yellow line is for adiabatic, so no radiative cooling. And the blue line shows the average profile of clusters in the case where cooling is included. And you can decide which one of these fits the data better. Both the amplitude and the shape of the profile seems to be reproduced in the cooling simulations much better, except for the inner region. So here we're starting to hit the ISM of the central galaxy, which we just don't resolve and don't model very well. But on the outskirts, the profile of observed clusters seems to be reproduced fairly well.
So that observation is wrong.
Right. But yet you're getting
that's right.
More or less right, because the stellar fraction is such a small.
It's not small. In these simulations, you know, this stellar fraction is the fact that you took baryons and converted significant fractions into stars is what makes the difference between this yellow line and the blue line.
But then between that and reality, there's an extra step, and it's small enough that apparently you're seeing that within the error, you get it right.
Which extra step are you talking about?
Well, you seem to be overproducing stars.
Right.
So what you're saying is that overproduction of stars is not fatal to whatever you...
Well, so suppose if you decided that with some means, for example, artificially, you can just switch off star formation and reduce the stellar fraction in these clusters by a factor of three, say, if you believe that the observed stellar fractions are so much lower, then this line, this blue line, would shift towards the yellow line. So this agreement would not be good anymore.
So you want a gas to be, you want some cold gas, you could
right.
argue that it's cold and it's...
I would not argue that I'm convinced that these simulations are reproducing the reality very well. The point I'm trying to make is that we're getting conflicting pieces of evidence from comparison to hot gas. Mm-hmm. When simulations are compared to hot gas, they actually seem to be doing a pretty good job. When we're comparing to stellar component, it seems to be a large discrepancy.
Mm-hmm. But how can that be? I mean, people good using question. X-ray to estimate the total, you know, hot gas in clusters,
yes.
And then they add that to, you know, to the total stellar mass, they got more or less universal.
No, you don't get universal.
You get less.
You get less. Okay. If you do it cluster by cluster, and I mean, these massive clusters have gas hot gas fractions of order of 11%, the mass fractions within R500. Whereas the expected universal one is 17%.
Okay.
So the difference is about more than a third.
No inconsistency either in the observation or in the
Well, my take on this is that if you add observed stellar fractions to observed hot gas fractions, you wouldn't you wouldn't get universal gas fraction. Okay. Dennis may weigh in here.
Well, you end up about 10 to 15% short on average. The uncertainties are still big enough that you could argue that it's consistent with universal. Mm-hmm. But if you just take the numbers at face value, you do end up a little bit short.
Well, so. So in this case, if you do statistical analysis, the errors are large. But if you try to do it for individual clusters, so for some of these clusters, the stellar masses were measured from Sloan, and the errors, just statistical errors, are very small. So if you just look at individual clusters, they seem to be below universal by more than 3 sigma. So it's not, I don't think the discrepancy is that small.
So Andrew, is that correct? So if you start with a hot halo, then for example, if the density is too high, then of course everything will cool down. But eventually we'll settle at a point where the cooling time is comparable to the age, basically, right? Mm-hmm. So then, is that what we are saying here? Because whatever you start with, even you start with a very, very large, you know, gas fraction, for example, but then because the density is high, then you cool more, but then what is left is really, you know, determined by the cooling time compared with the
This could be, yes.
And then, so then that does not matter. You always get the X-ray correct. What is,
yes, but what I'm saying is that if you try to reduce the stellar fraction, I think what you're saying is true for simulations. But suppose if you assume that there is some piece of physics, like AGN heating, that's missing in the simulation, and you try to reduce the stellar fraction to the observed levels, these profiles would be much higher. They would be much closer to this yellow line.
I see.
And so the shape would be inconsistent with the data. Plus the total mass of gas would also be inconsistent. So again, I'm just saying that the jury, I think in this case, jury is out. What I would argue is that at least for X-rays, these are not crazy clusters. I mean, we get the gas mass profiles, the temperature profiles outside the core pretty similar to the observed cluster. So you can decide for yourself whether how much you want to trust the simulations, and there is possibility that simulations suffer from this overcooling problem, and maybe reality is somewhere between this yellow and blue line. So the effects that I'll be talking about, particularly the magnitude of these effects, you should take with a grain of salt. But remember that the real effect will be somewhere in between non-radiative and radiative case, right?
So would it be correct to summarize that if the gas and amino parts were not converted into stars, it would have enough pressure to push the gas at half the zero radius further out, and that would make profile more like yellow
consistent?
Yes, right.
Or it's in some cold, so variance has to be controlled. That's maybe difficult.
One interesting thing, I think, is that most of this cooling is happening before HU1. So it's not a late time problem. So just turning on AGNs after HU1, which, for example, in some models like in the Millennium semi-analytic model, just turning AGN feedback late in the radio mode would not solve this problem, because most of these stars are already formed by redshift 1. So it's a high redshift problem, if it's a problem. So let me start with examples of how cooling can modify, can affect the mass distribution. And I'll start with triaxiality, where effect of dissipation seem to be particularly pronounced. And this was work that was done, actually, Julio Navarro talked about it during the conference 2 weeks ago. But this was work that actually was done over the last 15 years. And the effect has been seen in many different numerical studies, starting with Neil Katz in 91. The picture that I show you here is from analysis that we did a couple of years ago. And I think it strikingly shows the effect, where you see the same halo simulated in non-radiative regime and with the cooling. Again, the initial conditions are the same, but just the gas physics is different. You can see that in this case, the halo is highly triaxial, whereas here it's much more spherical. And the only difference between those two is that you included radiative cooling and star formation in the simulation. This is a...
Can you reach the point where the gas forms a disk, or does it never form a disk?
Yeah, here in this case there is a disk inside, yes.
Because disks are special.
Yes.
And what's special about disks is that if your potential is elongated one way, mm-hmm. the disk will elongate the other way.
Right. So
it works very hard to undo the triaxiality.
Yes, but in this case, there is a very disk in which most of the baryons are inside here, whereas in this case, the baryons are in elliptical galaxies. So
that's why I was asking if they're a disk or not, because I think disks are especially good
Right, so I don't think disk really is affecting things very much because the variant distribution in the central region of this object and this object is very different. In this case, it's disk-like. In this case, it's elliptical. So the effect is very obvious visually. You can quantify it in terms of axis ratio. So this plot shows a change in triaxial axis ratios, C over A and B over A, as a function of cluster-centric radius. So you can see that it's radius-dependent. It affects more in the regions of halos. And the effect is large enough, so the change in triaxial ratio, remember that average for clusters for C over A was like 0.4, 0.5, and you see the differences here of order of 0.2, 0.3. So it's a very large change in triaxiality, and that's why you see it so strikingly in visual images. And it's enough to completely undo this dependence of triaxiality on radius. You know, the fact that you, as you move in dissipational simulations, the mass distribution becomes more triaxial. So this effect compensates for it. Hills inside become much more spherical. So
the fact this is extended to very, very large radius, right?
Yeah.
So is that also because almost all the gas is now in the cold phase, right? In your simulation, is that?
Not all the gas. About 35% of the individual radius are in cold phase.
It's only 30%?
Yeah, and not all of them are in the center because about half of the baryons are actually in galaxies spread all over the volume. So there are galaxies. There is a central galaxy which contains a significant fraction of stars, but then there are the other galaxies as well.
Now you're talking about the clusters? Oh, yeah. Clusters, sorry.
Yeah, so these systems are all 10 to the 14 solar masses and above.
Does it look any different for lower mass?
We haven't looked for lower mass. But I think Volker Springel looked, he has a proceedings paper where he looked at different masses and found similar effect. And I think Julio Navarro 2 weeks ago also talked about galaxies finding similar effect as well. I think the effect is generic. It's some very basic physical effect. We actually have, in this paper, we have a kind of guess. We speculated why this happens. And now I don't believe that the explanation is correct. I think it's something simpler going on.
I'm confused about the sense in which this goes. So is that just the magnitude of the delta V over A, or is it?
It's a magnitude, yeah. So if for example, it tells you that on average, if you have axis ratios at this radius of 0.4, that on average, if you include cooling, the axis ratios will become 0.6. Okay. It becomes more spherical.
What do the error bars mean here? Is it dispersion?
It's a scatter from cluster to cluster. So we averaged about a dozen clusters here. The number that we had at the time. So what you see is a dispersion from cluster to cluster. But the trend is really, if you look at any relaxed cluster, the trend will be there. There is some difference in different radii, but the trend is always there. The second effect that's more familiar is the fact that when you include cooling, baryons tend to condense in the center, either through direct cooling or through merging of stellar systems. And they build up the central galaxy that's sitting near the minimum of the potential. And what it does is that it also drags dark matter. So of course, the creation of the central galaxy itself is depositing, you know, increasing the mass density in the center. But then dark matter density is also increased because dark matter has to respond to the potential change due to baryon condensation. And so dark matter is moving in the inner regions as well. So what this plot shows, it's a bit busy, but it illustrates the effect that as baryons condense in the center, and here's the difference in baryon distribution between non-radiative and radiative case, so you build up this central density distribution, the total mass profile is steepened as well. So this is dark matter only. So if you add the two, you see that the total mass profile is kind of behaves like this. But dark matter, you see that there is also increase. This is a non-radiative case. This is cooling case. And this is the fact that people knew about and modeled using so-called standard model of adiabatic contraction, which dates back, the first discussion of this effect that I know of dates back to 1967. And as many things in astrophysics, Zeldovich also did one of the first studies of it. They actually considered the general case, not just the circular orbits, but a lot of different orbits, pretty much everything that people discuss now. But it's not a very well-known paper, although it's published in English. But there is a number of studies that consider this effect, and there is a model for how you calculate it. So given the change in the baryon profile, the baryon distribution, this model predicts how dark matter distribution responds to it. So in this study, we looked at how well this model works, and the prediction of the standard AC model shown by dashed line. So in general, it works pretty well. It qualitatively gives you correct effect, but it all predicts, it seems to all predict the increase in density in the regions. But a simple modification to this model, which just changes the radius at which you evaluate the masses, the mass profile actually fixes this. And this modification can be motivated by the fact that the real orbits of particles in halos are not circular as assumed in the standard model, but they are triaxial on average. So you can figure out how this model has to be modified. And that was what we did in this study. And there are a couple of other studies recently that essentially argue the same point. A little bit of advertising that there is a code that implements this improved model called Contra. It was written by Oleg. And it's a very useful thing if you do mass modeling of different systems, for example, dwarf spheroidals or galaxies in which you have velocity dispersions, and you know you have a model for Baryon distribution, you can figure out how the meta should be modified. And Oleg tells me that at this workshop, he also tailored the code to mass modeling in Lensing. So if you're interested in it, ask Oleg, go visit the website. It's a useful code.
It's a shame none of the Gazeo group were here, because we could ask them what happens to orbits and Steckel potentials
if
the potential becomes...
In principle, there are different. So here we're motivated by orbits in dark matter halos. So we just measured what the typical orbits were, and that's what motivated the modification we did. But in different systems, like for example around the disks of galaxies, you may expect some other distribution of orbital parameters for particles, and you can modify this model appropriately.
Well, the nice thing about the Steckel potentials is that you have three analytic integrals of the motion. You can see what happens to the back invariance.
We actually did a test on Steckel type potentials, and the modified model seems to reproduce very well. We did the contraction, numerical contraction.
Uh-huh. Your modified model works.
We conserve the actions.
You conserve the actions. Okay. So if I wanted to avoid doing, I could just conserve the actions, and that would be fine.
No, because it's not the full effect. Because in the simulations, the actions are actually not strictly conserved.
Okay.
Because the evolution is dynamical and not adiabatic, and the potential is not spherical. So our model is not an exact solution to an approximate problem, but it's an approximate solution to an exact problem that is.
Is this orbit cooling problem?
Somehow,
which do we prefer?
I don't think so. I think the model is generic. So depending on how much you cool, the magnitude of the effect will be different. But I think the model actually takes into account, because the model just takes this difference.
So the fact that you input the final distribution of variance.
That's right. Right.
Scared.
Right. And I should point out that it's actually really, maybe we're a bit lucky that we have this simple model that works pretty well. Because if you think about assumptions of this model, the homologous contraction with circular orbits, man, these halos don't form like this. They assemble hierarchically through mergers. I have no idea why this works so well, but there are some ideas, of course. But when we started out on this project, I was convinced that we'll show that it's wrong. And we're surprised to see that it actually works pretty well. So now this increase, this effect that the dark matter density and the slope of the total mass profile increase considerably, so the mass distribution is steepened, it has very dramatic effect on strong Lensing, in particular on the predictions for abundance of tangential arcs. This is a work that was led by Eduardo Rosa and was on STPH a month ago. And what we show there is that if you look at these clusters in non-radiative, with gas dynamics, but in non-radiative and radiative regime, and you calculate the cross-section for creation of lone arcs, and lone arcs here are characterized by this number L, which is a ratio of length to the width of the arc, you find very different cross-section, pretty dramatic effect on cross-sections. So this plot show a map of L, so what kind of L you would get for a given point in space centered around the cluster center. And you can see that these two maps look dramatically different, right? Here you're producing lone arcs only if source located along the major axis of the mass distribution of the halo. Here's the Lensing cross-section is more spherical, but also the overall area is much increased.
By how much? The total cross-section?
So the total cross-section now, if you plot the actual numerical value, this is one of the clusters which is pretty representative. So if you look at every individual system, you find the same thing. You should you do different projections, and you can estimate what is the capability of this cluster to create arcs with a given length to width ratio. So this is the cross-section. So cross-section is defined as area of the source plane which is lensed by clustering to an arc longer than L, or larger length to width ratio larger than L. And this cross-section is really a critical piece of information to predict the abundance of such arcs given the number of sources. And people have tried to use counts of lone arcs as a constraint on cosmology, and we're finding a very surprising result that lambda CDM cosmology seem to be under-predicting the abundance of arcs by a lot. And in the last few years, several effects were identified that could actually mitigate this problem, or at least account for part of the difference. So here you're seeing one of these such effects, where cross-section in a radiative case and radiative cases different by a factor of 4 for moderate L, and actually by a large amount for very, very long arcs.
So are you counting arcs like, you know, at all radii, like, you know, or just the arcs, like, you know, they're forming at, a large radius, like 20, 30 arc seconds?
It's all radii within approximately virial radius of the cluster.
So what fraction of these arcs, you know, are forming, like, you know, by the CD galaxy?
Right in the inner region.
I think significant. Otherwise, this inner region would not have such a large effect on them, right?
Most of them
would be.
It would be good to see that cut, though, right?
Right. Since you're massively overcooling, right? You probably shouldn't be counting the arcs that are formed by the CD galaxy.
Right. Well, why not? I mean, the CD galaxies are there. What I was trying to argue is that we actually don't know by how much we're overcooling in these clusters. And even if, so real effect may be somewhere in between, but the effect will be there, right?
That's right. Well, the people have tried to do this, maybe not so realistically. Say, if you say, I assign a CD galaxy in a halo,
right,
and then, you know, you know more or less the mass, and then people find a factor of 2 difference in the cross-section. So maybe, you know, if you say scale down the mass of the central.
But my impression was when people did these exercises, when they added a CD galaxy, they actually didn't take into account the increase of the Knetter density and the steepening of.
But I think actually that's a very difficult, as you have shown very, you know, in your simulation. That's another opposite effect, is that the things become rounder, and that actually will help, or will not help.
It mitigates.
Yeah. Right. So I don't know, but you know, well, here it's a factor of 4. I mean,
It really depends on L, right? So it's factor of 4 around here. If you really can, for future samples, maybe not, current samples are too small to detect such very long arcs. But for the future large samples, you know, this prediction of 4 very long arcs is actually dramatically different, right? Because essentially, in this case, you predict nothing, and in this case, you predict very sizable amount. Observational constraint is that the abundance of arcs seems to be much higher than predicted from dissipational simulation. So this kind of difference would.
Less width, Andre, you could make an histogram, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Don't worry about the number.
But isn't the size of the source?
The problem of
Well, it's hard to do that. I mean, since most of the arc surveys from the ground, and you don't really resolve the short dimension.
The sampling will be very.
It's a little tricky. That's why people just sort of think cut it 10.
And I should say that the reason that it increased here is because here you're dealing with different types of lone arcs. These ones with small L's are just images stretched into an arc. At very large L's, you're essentially dealing with arcs which are merging of 2 or 3 images together. And this merging really depends on the size of the image. The probability of such merging depends on the size of the image, which determines this width of this wide band here. This wide band is very elevated probability of lensing, and essentially it's tracing caustic of this lens. And this is really sensitive to what's going on inside in the inner region. So that's why the probability at large L is so different, because the probability for merging images.
That's the cross-section to strong lensing as opposed to.
Right. Yes, that's right. Right. But this is two different regimes here. and that's why difference increases.
So given the huge difference that the cooling makes,
yes,
I don't understand why you get away with not making some zeroth order approximation to the heating from the central objects in these clusters. I mean, just AGM or servers.
What do you mean by not getting away?
Well, you have cooling, but not.
You mean that we should have overproduced arcs in the simulation? So.
Well, I'm assuming your cooling model.
Right. So assuming that it overcools.
Greatly overpredicts the cooling.
Okay. And then.
Just. I mean, based on how many.
I'm trying to understand.
Some approximation.
She wants you to
how much heating is offsetting the cooling.
Right. Well, we did it for one of the clusters. The toy model consisted of just shutting down the cooling by hand.
And what does it
and make this, yeah, it makes a difference, and you'll get a line in between these two.
Right.
So it's a really like with a fractional balance in condensed phase, it's a really a fairly just monotonic effect.
Yeah.
Although what happens as you have less cooling is that the scatter, if you see this, the scatter indicates the difference between it's the same cluster used in both of these lines, but the scatter indicates what the difference you get for different projections. And you see that for adiabatic case, the scatter is much, much larger because here there's larger triaxiality and the cluster is barely near the critical surface. So for some projections it's above, for some it's below, so you get a lot of scatter. In radiative case, it's very efficient lens anyway, and so you don't get such a difference between different projections. So what would happen for smaller fractions, that would be closer to this line, somewhere in between. And that, I think, is a way to think about all of the results that I'll be talking about. So the truth will be somewhere in between, probably. And I would argue, I don't think we know really whether it's closer to this point or closer to this point. We know that there are stars and galaxies, so this effect should be there, but we're not sure about magnitude.
So if you do this thing of turning off the cooling, does it solve the gas density profile as well, in that you retain the nice...
So if then, no, you don't retain. So then the hot gas would be inconsistent, both in terms of its mass fraction and in terms of profile. And that's what was my argument that, you know, there's something really strange going on because X-ray tells us that we should not turn off cooling, whereas optical observation tells us that we should.
High bar outflow.
Yeah.
So this is one strong application for lensing, but there is more actually. And what was a bit more surprising that in addition to the standard adiabatic contraction effect and steepening of the central mass profile due to condensation of baryons, there is actually a non-negligible effect on the mass distribution all the way to the virial radius. So what you see here is average profile for a bunch of clusters all scaled to the virial radius for the sample with a non-radiative case and with cooling. And this is a fractional difference between the two. So you have a strong effect in the center, but you can see that there is a fractional difference all the way to the virial radius of on the level of few percent. Few percent is not a lot, but you actually change in the virial mass, for example, for 5%. So that changes the mass function because the clusters are an exponential tail of the mass distribution. So small change in mass actually changes abundance quite a bit. And it actually also changes concentrations because if you fit NFW now, concentrations are very sensitive quantities. So you'll see that concentration will change as well. And
so this is a few percent that can be explained by the shrink of the orbits due to.
I think it's more complicated than this. I think the difference is that now you've condensed some of the mass in galaxies, mm-hmm. So you've changed the physics of how mass is tidally stripped, and how it merges. Mm-hmm. So I think you're just bringing more mass to the inner regions compared to say dissipation lens case where subhalos lose a lot of their mass in the outskirts. So it's more complicated than just orbits applied to radii. So this is an example of concentrations. This is for adiabatic case. This was discussed in a recent paper by Lin et al. And here we looking at three simulations of 60 H inverse megaparsec box, just pure dark matter with gas, but in non-radiative regime and with cooling. And you can see that there is effect on distribution of dark matter. So this is not total mass concentration. We're just fitting dark matter profiles. And dark matter does change. Dark matter distribution does change when you add gas, even in the absence of cooling, which is a bit surprising. This red line is not the same as black. So dark matter becomes more concentrated when you just add gas and do nothing else.
Why is that?
Good question. I'm sure we're trying to understand this actually. But that one idea. So there is this paper, recent paper by Lin et al. They have some discussion of why they think this happens. My general impression is that what happens is that when clusters form, they try to maintain essentially the same mass profile. So compared to dissipationless case, you end up with roughly the same. If you're just looking at non-radiative case, so then there is dynamics is still dissipationless, more or less, but dynamics of gas and Dacnet is different because Dacnet is collisionless, so it has to relax through some sort of relaxation process, collisionless relaxation, and gas can go through shocks and so on. So these two components undergo different relaxation processes, and they end up with different distributions, but the system tries to maintain the overall mass profile to be the same, and what happens is that gas ends up with more extended distribution, and Dacnet ends up with more concentrated. But this is just words. I don't have anything to relate.
This could be because there's an amino acid transfer.
There is energy transfer. These guys argue that there is effective energy transfer between the two components. But I think what I said essentially implies the same thing. It's just that it seems like the system in dissipationless case, when you don't have radiative cooling, tries to maintain the same profile. But the two components are distributed differently within this profile.
The shapes also change. I mean, just in
This we have not looked at. I don't expect them to change, but we have not looked at small changes.
Well, so there you might.
You may expect. Yeah, expect right. You're right. Right. Small changes you expect, yes. Smaller than what I was talking about, but yes.
And do you have a plot like this for the total mass distribution?
Yes. Well, I don't have a plot, but I can tell you how it will look like. So for the total mass distribution, this the difference between red and dark and black line will be very small. Because the total mass distribution actually doesn't change that much. But this difference between these lines in blue will pretty much remain.
So the same.
Yeah, maybe a bit smaller, but not much.
Yeah.
So the drastic effect that you see is, in the case with cooling, you increase the concentration of the Dacnet distribution. And these fits were done excluding the inner 10% of the virial radius. So we exclude the region where you increase the steepening. So it's not the inner steepening that's increasing the concentration. It's really just overall mass distribution that I showed you in the previous slide.
So if you exclude like the inner 10% of the real radius, I mean, how do you measure concentrations of 10? I mean, because the turnover
is... How are you? Is it just the RF?
Well, I should say that we probably exclude 10% of R500, which is 5% of the virial radius, because we essentially exclude the region where this effect, the inner effect, is very small, very large. So maybe somewhere out to here, 5% of the virial radius.
So it's interesting. If the mass difference is only then a few percent, how come the concentration?
I'm
confused about how you're then fitting the MFW.
So first, the mass is a cumulative quantity. So, but the second is concentration is very sensitive. If you change the distribution even a little bit, it's pretty sensitive.
And both RVR and RS.
Yes, both are changing, and I believe its main effect is an RS change, not RVR. Because I told you that mass, virial mass changes by 5%, but RVR is one third power of 5%, so it's a very small effect.
Does this have any effect on the outer slope of the density profile? What would be -3?
Well, I mean, the real halos are really not -3; they have a lot of scatter. Around the valley. So we have not looked at the actual profile, how much slopes change, but we just looked at the overall change of concentration. Right, so this effect on concentration actually it's pretty strong. It's not enough to explain that difference that I showed you from Buoti et al. Paper, because that difference was factor of 2, whereas what you see here is more like 20%. But it definitely goes in the right direction, so it boosts the concentrations. But this boost actually, so first of all, these simulations were somewhat lower resolution simulations than what we have for individual clusters. And this is just to show you that a similar effect exists for higher resolution simulations of individual systems, where we have a dozen or so systems simulated with adiabatic case shown in red and cooling in blue. On average, for these systems, you see increase of concentrations compared to adiabatic case.
I'm a little bit confused. So in your simulation, you say the concentration increased by 20 or something percent.
Mm-hmm. On average.
But, yeah,
yes.
But that's for halo, right?
For that matter, yes.
Yeah, but then in observation X-ray, how can they do that?
That's right. You have to look at total mass,
and that's why
Tomas asked the question. So I should have shown the plot for total mass, but I think what was interesting here is that this difference between red and black actually shows you that the Dacnet concentration changes when you include gas.
Really?
The total mass is not changing. But total mass will, concentration will still change compared with when you include cooling. So this effect will still be there, but the difference between red and black will be small. So effect is there in high resolution, so it's not, doesn't seem to be just a fluke of resolution. And it actually has very significant implications for weak lensing analysis, at least the future applications of weak lensing for precision cosmology. What you see here is an effect that this change in concentration has on the matter power spectrum, on the total matter power spectrum. And so this is just a fractional difference of P of K measured in simulations with gas compared to the P of K in the Knetter only simulation. And these are just, the panels are just different ratios, so ratio 1, 5. The effects are all qualitatively the same, although the scale shifts somewhat. And it's very busy, but if you just focus on red and blue lines, solid red and blue lines, they show you the change, the fractional change in the total matter power spectrum when you include just baryons without radiative cooling shown by red and baryons with cooling shown by blue. So you see that the power spectrum actually changes a little bit in the adiabatic case, although the effect is fairly small, it's few percent. But few percent is something that people actually worry about when they talk about the lensing, say, weak lensing constraints, for example, from LSST, because statistical power of those surveys is of order 1 to 2%. So a calibration of theoretical mass spectrum at 1 to 2% level is also required, whereas we're seeing here that gas has such effects, so up to 5%. At the scales where the cleansing surveys would actually be more sensitive, and these scales are roughly around K of 1. So essentially what it's telling you is that the gas cannot be neglected. If you're doing theoretical calibrations of the power spectrum, you at least have to include a non-radiative regime, because even in this case, you already have few percent effects. Yes?
So the blue line seems even much more dramatic.
Yeah, so the blue line is much more dramatic, and that reflects the fact that when you include cooling, the effect on concentrations is very, very dramatic, right? So here, the total mass concentration actually changes very little, and the reason you get a little bit of enhancement and a little bit of depression in this case is that at some scales, the signal is dominated by distribution of Dec matter, which is more concentrated. On smaller scales, we see in effect that baryons are actually less concentrated than halos, and there is suppression of power. So there is this generic kind of increase and then decrease of this fractional difference.
So this is dominated by the cluster part of the power spectrum? Even, I mean, on the left-hand side?
Here, yes. So the larger scales are dominated by clusters, yes, that's right. So as you move in to smaller scales, you start filling groups and galaxies and so on. But the largest keys are dominated by clusters. And for those of you who are not familiar with the power spectrum, this regime is really where transition between linear and linear power happens. So the scale of about 0.2 is still linear, even at ratchet 0, or close to linear. And 1 becomes kind of going nonlinear.
So what size were these boxes that you were running?
So the boxes were 68 inverse megaparsec. And as I said, this is definitely not very large. But we checked it at redshift zero, all of these simulations at fundamental mode are still linear. It means that nonlinear effects did not kick in on the scale of the box, which would be really bad. And of course, the cosmic variance would be very large. But what we are looking at here is just fractional difference. So all these boxes have the same initial condition, so they have the same large-scale structure in them. You will, of course, miss the largest clusters in such a box. So the effects that we are talking about could shift to even larger scales if you have a volume with larger systems.
But at K0.1, I mean, like, well, you're still seeing large effects. That's just surprising.
In the cooling case, yes, we see some suppression, which we don't fully understand why the suppression extends to such a large radius. But that's what we get.
So if you, say, take into account the effect of galaxies themselves, mm-hmm. and the effect is much smaller on large scale, or do we have any idea?
Effect of galaxies. So
yeah, it was just to say CD galaxies or all galaxies, which, you know, they are there, right? They
right.
should also contribute to this, but I don't know, you know, on large scale, whether they have any effect. Because if you have effect there,
So you're saying that we know that some fraction of baryons is in galaxy that have some.
That's right.
Some distribution.
Because if that is, you know, if this is it's just this effect, that's clean, right? Because you basically, well, it's not that clean if you have radiative cooling.
This is coming out of the fractional difference in total mass, right?
total power spectrum. Oh, you mean the effect?
Translate.
Yes, right. That's right.
The solar mass.
In fact, so what we did actually to understand.
No. So this is dark matter, right?
This is no, that's total.
This total.
Total
okay,
mass
so
power spectrum.
Okay.
There is actually a split. So if you now look at dotted and dashed line, they show you the effect for dark matter only and for gas only power spectrum. So you can see the differences. But the solid lines are for the total mass.
Okay. So then the question is that, you know, this total, how much is contributed by baryons themselves, and how much is contributed by, you know, the effect of baryons on the dark matter?
So that we can test, and we're doing this type of testing essentially by using a halo model like analysis. So we use a halo model where we include the gas distribution as one of the mass components, and this model actually gives qualitative prediction that are consistent with what we see in simulation. So this plot shows the same type of fractional difference at different redshifts, but now using the halo model where we included the dark matter profiles with a slightly increased concentration. The gas distribution is modeled by Burkitt profile with a core, which seem to describe the gas distribution simulations as well. And we are reproducing this slight increase and then decrease of power that we see in adiabatic simulations. And it can be interpreted in terms of the differences in gas distribution and dark matter. But in this case, there is no galaxy that you're asking for. In the case of cooling, this is a prediction of halo model, so it predicts this very sharp increase in power at small scales, and all of this increase is just due to increase of concentration of the overall mass distribution. So here we assume that the total mass is still distributed as NFW, just concentrations are boosted. So this model tells us that essentially what's happening here, that you see this strong increase just due to the fact that concentration of mass distribution increased. Right. So this is all that I ran out of time. So I'll stop here. Essentially, to summarize what I said is that cooling star formation affects the global matter distribution in halos. I think there is no question about this. But what the question remains about the magnitude of the effect, because I don't think we know how wrong the simulations are compared to observations in their treatment of cooling. The changes that we're seeing can significantly affect strong lensing cross sections and perhaps more worryingly weak lensing matter power spectrum, because essentially it tells us that we may need to include the gas physics in prediction calibration of the mass spectrum. But it's not that easy, because it's not just a technical problem anymore, but also we have to be confident that we're treating cooling effects reliably, which we don't have this confidence right now. So this complicates usage of lensing statistics, of course, for precision cosmology, unless we figure out to improve simulation significantly. But I think you can look at the bright side, and that at least for the strong lensing case, there is strong possibility that you can use strong lensing statistics to constrain physics of cooling. Because predictions, for example, for these longest arcs with merged images are very sensitive to what's going on in terms of cooling. So
the last point, actually, if you look at if you change sigma, it's a factor of 10 from, say, WMAP 1 to WMAP 3.
For arcs?
Yeah, for arcs.
Okay.
Because they are, you know, dominated by very massive systems. So,
well, I was careful here, and I said complicated.
Oh, no, I'm not saying.
I didn't say it makes it impossible.
Yeah,
no, I think it's still very interesting. I don't think it has to be determined, but these are things that you have to worry about.
No, yes, definitely.
So I'll stop with the pictorial version. I guess we'll ask questions.
So about your last point, I also think, I mean, one can either take a very optimistic view and say that it does constrain, Hubble's constraint, some things about the physics that's going on there. But one can also take a more pessimistic view, and that's also what I thought when I saw your pictures regarding the strong lensing cross section for the arcs. That, you know, in principle, there are several effects which could produce, several physics models which could produce the same effect in terms of increasing the lensing statistics for these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the challenge is going to be then to try and disentangle
mm-hmm.
which effects are actually the ones that are responsible for it.
Right.
So So I think there's quite a lot of.
Well, I think there may be a possibility, but it may need large samples and very high quality data, as Neil said. So if you have some distinguishing power between what kind of arcs you're observing,
yeah.
And then you can work at different L's, for example, you may be able to tell whether it's cooling or not.
Right. Well, right. And so, for example, you know, the qualitative properties of the arcs, you know, that are produced are quite different.
Right.
For these sort of like round mass distributions, mm-hmm. than they are for the more
right.
distributions.
So I don't know enough about what's currently available to know whether you can put constraints right now, even on this.
Well, so for example, you know, the arcs that you produce, like, you know, just my pure dissipation this simulation, you know, they almost always form on the major axes. Okay?
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, well, you know, so if you see lots of arcs forming on the minor axes of the cluster, then this is how you
use. Right, and it. The axis I expected to correlate, maybe not perfectly, but pretty well with the axis of the CD galaxy. So you can know what the axis is. So yeah. just doing a basic like symmetry statistic probably will tell you something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point.
So I'm confused about the use of the word triaxiality. You're saying that, you know, triaxiality increases with higher energy. But then you're also saying that clusters are prolate. So, when you say high triaxiality, do you actually mean high ellipsoidality?
I think we have a clash of cultures here. So I'm using, you know, the speak that we use. Essentially, yeah. So when I'm talking about high ellipsoidality, so when I'm talking triaxiality is of course property. If distribution is triaxial, maybe it cannot be more triaxial. So maybe it's incorrect.
More triaxial to me means that A is different from B is different from C. Is, you know.
The difference increases. That's what I mean.
Both
so. Right, and I think that's correct, although when I say increasing triaxiality, I mostly mean the shortest to longest axis ratio.
So a prolate blob's a good model for clusters?
For most of clusters, yes. So these cosmological halos seem to be mostly prolate, although there is a distribution of ratios, really. And if you're curious about this, for dissipational simulations, we have no good statistics for this. So in this paper by Brendan Allgood et al., there is a distribution. There are other studies by Jink also that show you distribution of axis ratios and the whole range of possible values.
So I took Jink's distribution and mapped it into 2D so we could use it for lensing. And the halos do seem to be alarmingly elliptical.
You mean the predictions are too elliptical, yeah.
Right. So maybe this rounding effect would sort of help explain the
color. It could, and it definitely helps in this problem that people have been discussing for the last several years for the Milky Way halo, because the tidal tails of the Sagittarius seem to be too coherent to be living in a very triaxial halo. Because in triaxial halo, you expect a lot of precession, whereas the tidal tails that observe seem to be very coherent. So having a more spherical halo helps with this. But I should point out that actually the effect is more complicated than this. So if you have a disk and a large mass distribution, central mass distribution is disk-like, then the halos actually adjust. So right around the disk, it becomes oblate and more or less aligned with the disk. So it's not prolate anymore. So disk potential changes the shape of the dark matter distribution in its immediate vicinity. It remains prolate if larger radii. Although even though the axis ratios change due to the presence of the disk.
Okay. And it's more or less axis symmetric.
If the disk is axis symmetric, then yeah, halo is as well. But it's only something that we saw kind of in a couple of studies that we looked at, and people are starting to look at the shapes of dark matter distribution in galaxy formation simulations now. So relatively few results compared to dissipationless case, where it was studied very extensively.
So on your weak lensing power spectrum business, the power spectrum is of course an RMS quantity, but I guess you also would predict an extra or difference in skewness in the shape of the.
Probably.
Diagnostic there to try to.
Possibly, yes. So we looked at the 2 points.
Tail, right? If it's dominated by clusters. So if you could
suppress
it, then the.
Right. I think it would be a natural next step. Although I'm not sure if these boxes would be good enough. Maybe they're too small. But the. Of course, the first thing we wanted to look at is two-point statistics.
I forget how sigma, you know, the inferred sigma a from a weak lensing survey relates to the P of K that you have on the y-axis of this plot. But is it possible that the current weak lensing surveys are already seeing, you know, the effects of variables by inferring a sigma a that's higher than everyone else?
It's a good point. I don't actually know. So maybe someone here would know. It depends on which scales they consider. And we right now, I don't have a plot for COFL, but we will have a plot of these effects in COFL space, so you can see what kind of ales are affected.
You disentangle that, right? Because there's the redshift distribution issue as well.
Yeah, and then there's the variance.
And that's similar, that's right. You could say, is the difference a typical thing?
Because I'm pretty sure that the theory, that you know, when they make the omega matter that fancy in ray contours, I'm pretty sure the theory is some dark matter.
Yeah, I think the possibility of this difference was not really appreciated, because the studies that have looked at this so far essentially concluded that the effect should be confined to very small scales and not extend to K1. And I think the reason is that people didn't realize that the concentrations of the overall mass distribution are actually affected by this, because only if you just take into account adiabatic contraction, the fact that it's steep and profound in the center, that only affects very small scales. So here you'll be okay. You only get this very large effect if you increase the concentration out of the virial radius.
Yeah, I guess that's the surprising thing, that the baryons are doing stuff.
Right. So what you're seeing here is just essentially just increasing concentration, and that was not appreciated that it was possible. I definitely didn't expect, so it was not something that people expected.
But do you find the same thing if you shut off the cooling? You know, if you're trying to do the drastic model to model the energy input from some other things like AGN or whatever, do you find the same?
So it's a good point. We didn't look. We have one cluster where we shut down cooling. I expect that all the effects will be monotonic, but we should look at this.
Right, so if there are no more questions, let's thank you.